Welcome, everyone, to episode 405 of the NBA podcast. We have a packed show for you today. We're going to talk about Blake Griffin's future now that he is on his way out of Detroit, Anthony Davis's injury, what it means to the Lakers, LeBron's MVP case, the All-Star game, all that good stuff, Andre Drummond's future as well, and then we're also going to touch on some of the hottest teams in the NBA, the Phoenix Suns and Utah Jazz. Before we get into all of that, a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we're recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed, engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today, as always, is a guy who I know is excited to talk more about All-Star later this week. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
It's going well, Brian. How about you?
It's going well. My dog tore his ACL last week, so that was kind of a bummer. So he is very much bedridden right now. But thankfully, unlike the entire south of the United States, it's actually like 45 degrees in Maryland today. So all of our snow is melting, which has been a huge win. Because let me tell you, having a dog with a torn ACL in a snowy slash icy backyard, would not recommend it.
I just am looking forward to the day you finally switch over to the metric system so I actually understand how warm or cold it is with your at your place.
Above 0 degrees Celsius, which it has not been for a while.
Great indicator. Yes.
There we go. All right, Mort. So let's start with Blake Griffin, who...
Just put a bow on last week's or last episode, actually.
Okay.
Because we talked about Andre Drummond there, and his former teammate, you know, who we're going to be catching up on, Blake Griffin, you know, this is all tied together. But I just want to wrap up the Drummond thing first.
Okay.
Because Draymond Green came out yesterday, I think, and said after the game that they played, you know, he was kind of upset. He was basically saying that fans had a very negative reaction to the James Harden trade request, and they were just not that very reactive when to the news of you know, Drummond coming out, basically Drummond being made available in the trade for the Cleveland Cavaliers. And, you know, I agree with that. I think that is totally fair. I think there is something fundamentally wrong if fans have decided that if a player wants out, there is something wrong with him. But if a team wants to trade someone, it's fine. There is something fundamentally wrong with that. That said, I just wanted to kind of touch on something here because I don't think it was the trade request from James Harden that bothered a lot of people, including us, who actually criticized him. Mm. I think it was the follow-up behavior of just not giving a damn about anything and just putting his teammates in a situation that was completely unfair. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't have a problem with a guy asking for a trade. I just don't. That's fine. It's how you conduct yourself while doing so.
Yeah, like, say, going to a club during a pandemic instead of going to training camp and then having to sit out for a good portion of training camp as you pass coronavirus protocols.
For example, yes.
Yes, or actively not giving a damn on the court. And, I mean, there is the one clip of him just, like, dribble. Someone, I think it was John Wall, was calling for the ball on the other end of the court, and Harden just, like, flings it 5 feet away from him, and, yeah, like, didn't even move. It was just, I was obviously apathetic to his entire situation there, and was, I mean, it's similar to what Jimmy Butler did with the Timberwolves, where, you know, that turned out to be funny because of the infamous practice where he destroyed the starters with third stringers and then cursed out the entire front office. But yeah, I mean, it's the same idea of like, okay, sure, you could want a trade, that's fine. But yes, in the meantime, as you are negotiating, you know, your exit from that franchise, you still have to, you know, you're still being paid billions of dollars to conduct yourself professionally. And right. that's where your reputation starts to get sullied, is if you don't do that.
Right. And this holds true for teams as well. If teams are putting someone on the trade block, I expect them to do right by those players as well. Mm-hmm. So let's say that Andre Drummond, you know, reached out to management and said, you know what, while you're shopping me, I actually want to play.
Yeah.
Fine. He should get that benefit. If that was a criteria for him, the Cleveland Cavaliers should have given him the right to do so. No questions asked. And they're not doing that to protect their own interest in terms of not hurting his trade value. And I say trade value, and I'm kind of laughing because what trade value? But that's an entirely different situation. But yeah, I think it just goes both ways. I think Draymond has a very, very fine point in general in terms of holding teams to the same expectations as players. And I think that's what we need to take away from his post-game comments. And honestly, and this is just a broader point to the issue, I really love how animated Draymond has become recently. And mm-hmm. just he's reached that point where he just no longer gives a damn.
Yeah.
And to a whole new degree. And he's just calling out BS when he sees it. I appreciate that. I mean, even if his logic was maybe a little bit faulty last night because of the way he framed the situation, like, fair. But I appreciate what he's trying to do. I appreciate him just speaking truth to power. I totally get it.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's worth noting what happened here. So the Cavaliers on Monday, just, I guess, Woj and Windhorst were the first to report that they're just no longer planning to play Drummond. You know, as we suspected when they acquired Jarrett Allen in the James Harden trade, you know, Woj and Windhorst said they're moving to make him the long-term starting center, and they believe it's unfair to Drummond to limit his minutes as they transition to Allen. They tried an Allen-Drummond front court, and it worked as poorly as you might expect.
Right.
And, I mean, to be fair to the Cavs, Drummond has not looked especially engaged in recent weeks. I mean, understandably, he's upset. Chris Fedor of Cleveland.com said he didn't want to move on. Like, he liked being in Cleveland, and he kind of was hoping for it to be a long-term thing. And then, you know, I can't blame the Cavs for acquiring Jared Allen at that price. And, you know, especially given his higher upside than Drummond, plus he's a lot younger, he fits better with the Sexland backcourt moving forward. So I get it from their perspective, but I also get it from his perspective. I can get being frustrated because you think, you know, I'm going into free agency. My market is probably not going to be all that robust. The Cavs have a need for me, so it actually seems like this might be one team that's going to pay me a lot of money. And then they go out and get Jared Allen, and now you're back to square one. You have to survey the marketplace. And he probably realizes, like, that nine-figure offer is not coming. It's, I mean, maybe, as we always say, it only takes one team, but I just can't imagine a team throwing $25 million a year at him. So,
no, I'd be shocked.
Yeah.
I'd be absolutely shocked.
So I can get his frustration as well, but yeah, I think as you said it well, Mort, it's not, from Draymond's perspective, we definitely weren't ripping James Harden for requesting a trade. In fact, I think we encouraged that.
Very much so, yes.
You know, I know you're not a big American football fan, but it's the same thing that's happening with another Houston team, the Houston Texans, their quarterback, Deshaun Watson. The team has just so comprehensively failed him that mm-hmm. he requested a trade, and absolutely no one around the NFL is blaming him at all. Like, everyone is like, yes, good, get him out of there. You just don't want to ruin a guy's career. Like, if you have a really promising talent, you just hate to see it go to waste on a bad, inept team, which was happening. It's happening with the Texans. It, you know, seemed like it would happen with Houston and Harden because Tillman Fertitta is cheap and broke and refused to pay as much as he should for having a top five player in his prime. So, you know, I think with the Cavs and Drummond, I don't know that that's the case, but we'll see this story again. And it's similar, you know, we've been clamoring for a Bradley Beal trade for how long now? And it's not, you know, I know Bradley Beal, it's somewhat tangential here, but, you know, he came out recently and said, like, he feels like he's being persecuted for, you know, not asking out, but then he sees all these other guys who do ask out and want to go to a super team, and people hate them for that. So he was also frustrated. Like, there's a double standard here between, you know, you want players to stay, but then they want to stay, and you're like, wait, no, you should want out. You should try to go somewhere else. And he's like, I just want to make the Wizards good. And from our perspective, I think it's not, I don't think anyone's mocking him for that. I think it's just, we don't want to see his career wasted too. He is in the prime of his career, and he is an incredible player, and it sucks that he's on one of the worst teams in the NBA.
And if I can be allowed to make a plug, I actually released a video yesterday about Bradley Beal on the NBA show's YouTube page. So you can go track that down. And today I'll have a video out on Andre Drummond.
There we go. All right. Well, yeah, stay tuned for that then. Okay. Let's go to Blake Griffin now.
Because
that, I forget which one came first, Drummond or Griffin, but I think it was Drummond. Yeah.
And then, Drummond, yeah.
And then shortly thereafter, Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN reported the Blake Griffin and the Pistons have mutually agreed that he will be out of the lineup until the franchise and his representatives work through a resolution on his playing future. They are going to continue to pursue trade scenarios involving him, and they're also talking about a potential contract buyout. Woj said it could eventually come into focus. Doesn't sound like anything is super imminent in that regard, probably because Blake Griffin is owed a ton of money over this season and next, and I don't think the Pistons want to swallow his $30+ million cap hit next year if they don't have to. So, Mort, let's see. Blake Griffin is owed $36.6 million this year, and he has a almost $39 million player option next season.
You know how you always say that it can't be a bad contract if it's 2 years?
Yep.
This one is testing that theory to the limit.
It really is. So we tried to rehome Andre Drummond a couple episodes ago. So if you want to listen to that, you know, we're not going to go into trade scenarios for Andre Drummond today because we did it already. Just go back and listen to the previous episode. Can we rehome Blake Griffin? Is it even possible with that big of a cap hit this year?
See, so that's kind of the thing. Yesterday, I was kind of asking around, is Blake Griffin arguably the worst contract in the NBA? Simply because there doesn't seem to be any type of return that makes sense. And I was pointed out that Russell Westbrook has an additional year on his contract.
Mm-hmm.
So you could make the argument that because Russ has another year, he's probably the worst long-term contract that you could fetch if you're the Detroit Pistons. The thing is, though, like, let's say the Pistons were, like, open to taking on longer money than what Blake Griffin is owed. So, like, they get a contract that expires in 2023 instead of Griffin that expires in 2022. You would kind of presume that the Pistons would get an asset for actually taking on longer money. But that situation in Washington, that just wouldn't work because they wouldn't be interested in doing that.
Right.
They would not be interested in giving up an asset because of the way that they are currently constructed. And also because Russell Westbrook, despite his faults, is a way more productive player. So to answer your question, no, there's really no way to gift wrap Blake Griffin to anyone or pivot him into something else. I don't see what a deal should be. Andrew Wiggins has played just well enough to the point where he's just too valuable to move in a Blake Griffin deal, which, there we go. I mean, yeah, if that doesn't scream all-star, as some Golden State Warriors fans have tried to claim for Wiggins, I don't know what does. You're finally worth more than Blake Griffin's contract. Well done. Well done. That's definitely all-star worthy. But no, I there's just, like, the Cleveland Cavaliers aren't going to take him for Kevin Love, for example.
Right.
I mean, Love is just easier to implement. There is, who out there is willing to give the Pistons an expiring contract for Blake Griffin? No one. Not unless they get paid for it in terms of draft compensation or a young guy or whatever. But again, the Pistons themselves, just like Washington, are not in a situation where they can afford to give up young assets. Presumably, let's just say the Bulls, who have Otto Porter's expiring contract. If they said, we, you know, would take on an extra year by taking on Griffin, they would want Sadiq Bey. Mm-hmm. And the Pistons would be like, no. Right. No, that's not going to happen. And then the Bulls will just say, well, that's our price. Bye. Enjoy Blake Griffin. And so, no, here's what I see. I see a buyout. I think that's far more likely, but not this year. Yeah. Next year.
Right. Or, I mean, Blake can give money back in the buyout, right?
He can, and he would have to give up something of, you know, of substance if he wants to get out now.
Right.
But then also this, and this is super important. If Blake Griffin hit the free agency market right now, would there even be suitors?
Like, I mean, DeMarcus Cousins, despite all of his injury history, continues to find teams. So I think some team would gamble on him. Would they give him more right. than a minimum? Maybe, but probably not at this point.
Right. That's what I'm thinking. Like, it would have to be that type of contract, right?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. Is it's really Griffin's cap hit. He has. I'm looking at Spotrac. That has the list of the biggest cap hits of the NBA right now. This season, he is supposedly eighth on that list. So he is sandwiched right between LeBron James and Paul George, to put that into perspective.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Klay Thompson is not far down the list, but despite his injuries over the past few years, I don't think the Warriors are doing a Klay Thompson for Blake Griffin deal. Even, you know, Blake Griffin is...
Yeah,
he's active this year, which Klay Thompson is not, so he could raise their short-term upside. But I think that's the fundamental question is, you know, how helpful is Blake Griffin right now? How helpful is this reduced version of him that is shooting 36.5% from the field this year, 31.5% from three? He's averaging 12 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists.
Right.
So does
he's serviceable? As a backup, maybe?
Yeah, but, like, does he meaningfully... If Blake Griffin moves somehow, whether it's buyout or trade, to a contender, does he meaningfully improve their championship upside?
I think the analytical term you're looking for is,
eh. Right. Like, you know, if he ends up... Let's say the right. Pistons do buy him out, and he ends up... in Boston or in Brooklyn, both of whom could use front court reinforcements. Does he move the needle for them significantly?
So I'm not going to sit here and say he couldn't swing a playoff game.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also saying it seems unlikely.
Yeah.
So it really comes down to what you believe he can be in this format, because he looks toasted.
Yeah, I would agree. I wonder, so the only, I mean, I'm scrolling down the list of the biggest cap hits here. Kevin Love is the one guy who might be obtainable, but I think you're right, Mort, even though the Pistons would be taking on an extra year, I don't think they make that deal. The next name that really pops up in terms of available options, Andre Drummond is there. The Pistons and Cavs could do a problem for problem trade.
He knows the system.
Yeah. And they love their centers there in Detroit.
Boy.
Yeah, Otto Porter. And then the only other name really in, like, the top 50. I mean, you know, the Spurs will bring them up all the time. They have a ton of expirings with, you know, I don't think they're trading DeMar DeRozan, who's playing at all-star level. But, like, LaMarcus Aldridge, who is equally washed at this point, and... You know, they have Rudy Gay, Patty Mills as other expiring, so they could do it, but I just don't see their incentive to do it unless they're getting something valuable back.
There is none.
Yeah. And that's the problem for the Pistons. They should not care about clearing cap space for this summer. So right. There is no incentive for them other than to do right by Blake and not make him waste another year of his career. But they have no incentive to give up an asset to get off of his contract. It would be an actively bad idea for them to do so. I think the Spurs are out. The one team that I could maybe see is OKC with Horford. And then with Detroit having full intention of then flipping Horford for something else. But I don't know why OKC does it unless...
Yeah, I was just about to say, why would they want to do that? Right. What do they benefit here? They would want a draft pick.
Yeah, I would think so as well. Because, OKC is probably sitting there. If Detroit is acquiring Horford with the intention of flipping him for a pick, why would OKC not just flip him for the pick instead?
Right, exactly. This is what I'm saying. You know, even though this is a 2-year contract only, in theory, it's probably one of the worst contracts in the NBA because there's just no way to move off of it that makes sense for both parties.
Right. Yeah. Victor Oladipo over Blake Griffin?
Like, no. Why would they do that?
Gary Harris plus... have to be Gary Harris and Will Barton, I think, for Blake Griffin.
Yeah, no, why... look, even despite his struggles, the Nuggets love Gary Harris as a locker room guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's a really solid human being. Why would they want to get rid of that? No, it just does not make sense. And, look, I get the whole Jokic-Griffin thing. That would have been fun in Griffin's prime.
Right.
Now? Not so much.
Yeah. Yeah,
Has Blake Griffin even dunked once this year? Not saying that that's an indicator of anything, like necessarily, but just anecdotally. Has he dunked once this year?
Let me see.
He has not.
Is that true?
He has not dunked once this year.
It's not on Basketball Reference, at least.
And last year he had 5. So that means over the past 2 years he's had 5 dunks.
Wow. Well, he reinvented himself. Good for him.
Yeah. That's one way to look at it, sure.
Yeah, I am really struggling to find, like, Memphis could do Gorgui Dieng plus one of Justice Winslow or Dylan Brooks.
No.
Yeah. I ultimately think if Griffin wants out before... I mean, he could just turn down the player option. That's one choice. Or...
like, why would he, though?
Right. But, you know, if he just wants to go play for a not-rebuilding team, if he's that desperate to go play for a non-rebuilding team, he does have the option here. You know, it's not...
Yeah, but it's $39 million. At some point, you're just willing to accept certain things if it's $39
million. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean... This is the problem if you sign a big contract and then you know for whatever reason injuries are just you get old and lose a step. This is the problem with signing that type of a contract. Like it has some major downside both for team and player. And now Griffin's in a situation where I just don't see an easy way out unless he takes a buyout.
Right.
It's a bummer. I hope.
Yeah.
I hope they find a solution because, it would suck if this is how his career, how he goes out.
I don't think he goes out this way, but I do think this is the version of which he. This is probably the best version we're going to be getting in terms of like he's not going to be a high flyer. He might be an high IQ guy who can make the right passes, like mm-hmm. be a rebounder, and then hit the occasional three. Like okay. Well, more than that, he's actually become a pretty good shooter. But,
yeah,
you know, he's just not going to have the role. Moving forward, I just don't see a scenario where any team is going to say, you know what, let's give Blake Griffin 32 minutes per game.
No. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess could he have a Nick Batum-esque resurgence on a team where he actually has stakes to play for?
Anything is possible. We wrote off Batum entirely, and as it turns out, he was just stalking it for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So, I guess anything is possible. I don't think it behooves Griffin to right now. If Griffin right now is basically just biding his time and he's not putting in the effort and that's why he looks so bad, then it's probably a pretty poor, you know, play on his part, because that's not going to improve his trade value. That's right. Not going to increase his odds of getting out of there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly possible. And I think if he was surrounded by more talent, that would help as well. Like, if you do put him on Boston or Brooklyn, where he doesn't have to be the number one option, he could be, you know, a complimentary guy on offense and he could just serve as a playmaking hub. That's certainly an area in which he's been great throughout his career. So right. I do think he could provide some value, but yeah, I think the fundamental question is, A, how do you get him on such a team given that big cap hit? And B, how much does he improve your championship upside?
I almost want to go back to the podcast that we recorded back in 2017 when he actually signed that five-year deal.
Oh boy.
I don't remember what our reaction was at the time, but I'd be curious to find out.
Yeah, I can't imagine we were super high on it, but maybe.
No, but I can't imagine we expected this.
No, either. No. Well, I mean, you know, given his injury history, this was certainly within the range of possible outcomes.
Right. Oh boy! You know what? I'm actually after this podcast, I'm gonna go back to.
You're gonna go digging.
I'm curious. That's a podcast almost 4 years old. I mean, this is the benefit of having a podcast that's almost 5 years now.
And if
we actually have an archive to go back to.
If we were high on the contract at the time, please delete that episode.
Welcome to episode 405. No, probably we did the last time. Oh yeah, it's still episode 405.
Perfect. Yeah. All right, let's turn our attention to another often injured big man, Anthony Davis, who is now out for the next at least 2 to 3 weeks after suffering a calf strain Sunday and is unlikely to return prior to the All-Star break. He had tendinosis in his right Achilles last week, missed a couple games. And then on Sunday, he aggravated the injury. He and Jokic bumped legs in the second quarter of Sunday's game and is now out for, you know, at least the next couple weeks. I think first thing is just what does this mean for the Lakers, who, you know, who have been really good so far to start this year? They're second in the West at 21-7. Do you think they're going to be able to maintain that pace with Davis now gone for, you know, the foreseeable future?
I don't care. They're so good. It doesn't matter if they can, like, what do they do in the regular season? I don't care. Even if they end up having a lower seed, then he's back for the playoffs. And then they're going to just pound people. It doesn't matter. Take the time off, AD. It's fine. It's a vacation midseason. What are they right now? It's like 21-7 or something. Mm-hmm. 21-7. It's fine. Take a couple weeks off. Then afterwards, then LeBron has a quote unquote foot situation, and he'll take a couple weeks off. It's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter. Just get healthy. It's the Lakers. They're absolutely loaded, and they're a well-oiled machine at this point. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think they are very smart to be conservative with their management here, because I agree with you. They're seeding. Would they like to be the one seed? Of course. Do they care if they're the two or the three? Probably not. I don't think they're looking up at the standings, even though Utah is ahead of them and the Clippers are right there as well. I don't think they care particularly. So,
right.
Yes, I think they fall back a little bit. Anthony Davis is that important to them. They do have Kyle Kuzma, who's been playing well this year, and I think he's probably going to slide into that starting lineup in place of AD and get some more minutes, more burn. Montrezl Harrell is probably going to have a bigger role as well. So,
right.
You know, it'll be a good opportunity for those guys to really cement their roles in the rotation heading into the playoffs and kind of expand what they're doing in the meantime. But yeah, this obviously not great news for the Lakers overall in these next couple weeks. So here is, you know, LeBron James, we're a third of the way into the season. Depending on who you talk to, if it's someone objective or someone in LeBron's propaganda machine, he's either in the mix for the front runners or for MVP, or he is so far ahead of the pack that the race is already over. if you are in the former camp and you are actually paying attention to teams outside of LA, what do you think this AD's injury does to LeBron's MVP case? Because I'm of two minds here.
So do you mean LeBron's legitimate MVP case or LeBron's media narrative MVP case?
Well, both, because I think if the Lakers do fall back a little bit, that's going to hurt LeBron's case just because he won't have the team right. success angle, but he'll have to theoretically put up bigger numbers. He's just going to shoulder more of an offensive and defensive load without AD. And if the Lakers don't really fall back very far, or, you know, if they tread water without AD, then that's only going to strengthen LeBron's MVP case, I think.
Why are we talking about LeBron as the MVP? This has been, like, I know it's been a subject for a while now, and it's gaining traction on Twitter, but why are we there?
I don't know why we're there. I don't know why anyone would call him the far and away front runner. I think he's right. in the mix for sure.
Yeah, but he's not the clear cut front runner. It's ridiculous.
No. Well, unless, I don't know, did Nikola Jokic and Joel Embiid retire?
I think they did, because okay. that's the only explanation I would have. Yeah. I mean, both have been better this year. And look, again, I think people are upset that Milwaukee didn't make it further in the playoffs, but why are we overlooking Giannis in all this either? Yep. I mean, he's at 28 points, 11.5 rebounds, almost 6 assists, 56% from the field. I mean, those aren't Sunday league stats.
No. Yeah, I don't get it. I mean, you know, right now, Basketball Reference has the MVP award tracker, which ranks candidates based on previous precedent. LeBron is currently third in their model, but Jokic and Embiid are ahead of him, and Giannis and Kawhi are not that far behind him. Also, Dame has been sensational, Luka has been sensational, Stephen Curry's been sensational. This race is just not over at all. It's wide open at this point in the season. So I'm curious to see, you know, how these Lakers fare in AD's absence over the next couple weeks, because I think that's either going to really put LeBron in that actual front runner mix, or, mm-hmm. you know, if they struggle a bit without him, which I think is certainly possible. Without him, didn't they go to overtime? Yeah, they played double overtime against the Pistons, and then went to overtime twice against OKC before LeBron bailed them out both times. So, you know, both of those teams are surprisingly competitive. I'm not taking away anything from either of those teams. But without Anthony Davis, when you've got games coming up against Brooklyn on Thursday, Miami on Saturday, Utah the following Wednesday, Portland, Golden State, Phoenix, Sacramento, that's the schedule. You know, really, they have two gimme games. They have Tuesday tonight against Minnesota, next Monday against Washington. Other than that, I mean, there's a realistic chance the Lakers could go, 3-6 in this stretch, 4-5 in this stretch, or even 2-7, worst case scenario. So if they go 7-2 despite playing that many good teams, I think all of a sudden LeBron deservedly will be getting MVP front runner buzz. But if they do really hit a speed bump in these next couple weeks, that's going to certainly hurt his case heading into the second half of the season.
I just think this is a legacy award.
Yeah.
It's one of those, let's give it to you one more time before you head out the door. And I there's only one scenario in which I would support that, and that's if he had never won an MVP before, and he'd been super deserving over the course of his career. But he's won 4. This is one of those, let's see if we can get you up on the same Echelon as Mike with the five MVPs. So we really, because that allows us to create way more clicks. Mm-hmm. That provides us with many more articles that we can write for our respective medias.
Well, if he were playing this well and there weren't other players also putting up ridiculous numbers and helping right. their team win, that would be one thing. But
agreed.
When guys like Jokic and Embiid are having the season type of seasons they're having, and again, even Dame and Steph should be in this conversation as well.
Yep.
When you have that much legitimate competition, it's similar to the All-Star that we're gonna, you know, we'll talk about. We already did a whole episode about it, where it's like there are too many deserving candidates and not enough spots to go around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, that's a good problem for the league to have. That's a great problem for the league to have. But yeah, you know, LeBron has been fantastic this season. He has. There just have also been a number of other players who are having similarly great seasons. So I'm curious to see how that narrative evolves over the next couple weeks, because you know most of these games are on national TV too. So it's not like we're gonna have Lakers play Minnesota today. Okay, no one's gonna watch that game. Lakers play Brooklyn on Thursday. Everyone's gonna watch that game. You know?
Yeah, maybe. I'll see what else is on. No, I'm kidding. I'm probably going to check that out as well. But
yeah.
No, I hear you. I just think it's very media driven. I don't disagree with you that LeBron has had a fantastic season. He always has fantastic seasons. But I just think we've reached that point where it seems that there is this idea that he just needs that one more for insert reason here. And let's just bring up Luka for a second, by the way, because you and I talked at length about him having to get into playing shape mm-hmm. during the first couple of months of the season.
Yep.
Well, so he's played 28 games, and I just want to read you the last 14 games
yeah.
worth of stats. So the last half of the first 28 games he's played this year. 32 points. Well, to be fair, 31.9, mm-hmm. but, you know, 32 points. 7.3 rebounds, 9.3 assists. He's hitting 38.5% of his threes, 49% overall, 83% from the line on 9.1 attempts. And you can see he's also, like, he looks more lean now.
Yeah.
It took him a couple of weeks to just shed some of that off-season weight or whatever.
Yep.
But he's locked in. He's had three 40-plus games here in February alone. So, yeah, 40, 42, 46, and 44 over the course of this month alone. I want to say he's there, Brian. Like, he's getting there.
Yeah.
If we just look at his February numbers, it jumps up to 33 points per game. So, and 43% from downtown. I'm going to say he's going to be in the conversation.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that it's going to be relevant.
Team success is the only thing holding him out right now. But, I mean, prior to their loss against Portland on Sunday, they had won four straight and five of their last six. So, you know, now that they have Kristaps back, he still seems to be a step slow defensively. But, you know, if you just look at the box score, he's averaging like his normal 20-8. So if he's getting back into form as well, yeah, they have a real chance to pick up steam in the second half of the season, for sure.
Is this where we should rehash the old conversation about most valuable and the definition of the award? Because if you took Luka off this team, blah, blah, blah. We've gone through this numerous times, but I'm just saying, if we take the award literally, and if you take LeBron James off the Los Angeles Lakers while Anthony Davis is there, and you take Luka Doncic off the Mavericks with Kristaps Porzingis there, who has the bigger drop-off?
Yeah, it's a fair question. Jokic, I think, would win that pretty resoundingly.
Yes. Yes, if we include more people than just Luka and LeBron, I would agree. I think Jokic... Well, one more name.
Embiid.
Well, that too, but I'm thinking of teams who are not necessarily in the playoffs right now.
Oh,
but
Levine?
Levine.
Yeah.
Levine and Jokic would probably be the leading candidates for that award if you took it literally. No Levine on the Bulls? Good lord.
Yeah.
That would be ugly.
And I will say this about the last thing I want to touch on with AD's injury is, you know, assuming Woj's timeline is correct and he's not back before the All-Star break, he's going to be selected for an All-Star spot, but that opens an alternate slash injury spot for someone else. So, right. You know, we'll make All-Star reserve picks, and I'm pretty sure both of us will have him as one. So we should also start thinking about who we can name as a replacement for that as well. But it would not surprise me if Anthony Davis is not the only All-Star. I don't want to say who, because he's actually hurt. But I'm going to guess he will not be the only injury replacement selected in that game.
Right. I still don't think LeBron or Giannis are going to play.
Yeah, and Embiid has... he didn't say as much, but he's been having, you know, he was out last night with back tightness. He's had it for the last couple weeks. And I think Tim Bontemps of ESPN asked him last week about it. And he's like, well, we'll see how I'm feeling. But, you know, I've been right. kind of banged up. So, I think any player that's been nursing a, you know, an off and on injury is going to use that as an excuse to get out of this thing this year. We'll see.
I would agree.
All right, boy, let's turn our attention to a couple teams that have just been wrecking everyone lately. Let's start with the Phoenix Suns, winners of six straight games. Really the only thing separating them from a 10-game win streak, they lost 123-101 to the New Orleans Pelicans on February 3rd. But otherwise, they were 8-8 on January 27th, and they are now 17-9. So it seems like they have really hit their stride. They're currently the number four seed in the West. They have a half game or a full game lead over the Portland Trail Blazers. And they've got, I mean, tonight's going to be a big test for them. They have Brooklyn tonight. But then, you know, relatively speaking, the rest of their first half schedule isn't super daunting. They have New Orleans, Memphis, Portland, Charlotte, Chicago, Minnesota, Lakers, Warriors. So, you know, Portland's tough. Lakers are tough even without AD. Warriors, Steph is just nuclear. So, they've got some tests coming up, but I think it's probably safe to assume they're going to be in that top half of the conference mix. What have you seen out of the Suns lately?
Well, so over the past 4 years, Jay Crowder has shot 39.9% from the field. He's generally not been a high-efficiency player.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I have to ask, is Jay Crowder one of the best players in the league who is low-efficiency overall from the field?
It feels that way. It certainly does.
Right? I mean, even offensively, he'll just hit those threes at the right time, and some of them will just be backbreakers. I think he gives Phoenix such a wonderful bailout option, mm-hmm. not just offensively, but also defensively. He can pick up some things here and there. I just think he's been such a huge, an underrated piece to get into that team. Like, that trio of him, Mikal Bridges, and Cameron Johnson has been superb at just spotting up and hurting opponents when they overload on Devin or Chris or DeAndre. It just seems those guys are just, yep, if you guys are overloading, we're moving away from the basketball, we're making ourselves open, and we're ready to launch.
Yeah.
I think it's simple basketball, but it works.
Yeah. And, I mean, we noted earlier in the season, there seemed to be, it was like the bench was what was keeping Phoenix afloat. Like, Chris right. Paul, Devin Booker were clearly just trying to figure each other out and figure out how best to play with one another. And then, you know, DeAndre Ayton had a couple monster games, but all things considered, wasn't putting up huge scoring numbers either. This is the last 10 that Phoenix has played, so Booker's played 8, Chris Paul's played 9. Booker's averaging 27.4 points, shooting 52.6 overall, 40.9 from 3. Chris Paul is at 19.9 points, shooting 53.1 overall, 45 from 3. Also chipping in 7.3 assists, 4.7 rebounds. You know, Mikal Bridges, it's just been such a steady force for them. Even though his three-point shooting has cooled off as of late, he's still a premier young 3-and-D option in this league.
Yeah.
you know, they got Dario Saric back recently. He is a great fit in that backup center role for them. You know, they just seem like they are really starting to hit their stride. Cameron Payne also just recently returned. And is a, you know, a nice, he had a great end of season run last year and doesn't seem to have missed a step so far this year. I'm a huge fan of this Suns team. I buy it. You know, last year I remember the Suns got off to a good start and so many Suns fans were taking premature victory laps and we were like, okay, have your fun while you can. This year, I don't think these victory laps are premature. I think Phoenix is legit this good.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely last year, we saw that that confidence level in Suns fan grow. I think that's the kind way to say it. And then as the year went on, it became more and more apparent they were just that step away. And getting Chris Paul in there just basically orchestrated everything. And you still have Devin, who's allowed to be on the ball. You have the evolution of Mikhail. You also got Crowder. You know, Cameron Johnson is a year more experienced. Dario Saric is a good point as well. Like, he has come in and just be allowed to play his game, I want to say. When he was in Minnesota, I felt he was a little bit, I don't know what the word is, limited, handcuffed, you know, somewhere along those lines. Whereas he's playing more of a free movement caliber of basketball now, which seems that the Suns have just allowed him to do. There is this whole dynamic of when he comes into the game, he has the green light to make decisions, which, you know, kudos to Monty Williams for actually giving him that, I think. But yeah, no, I buy them as well this year. I mean, now we reached the point where we have to include, I think, Devin Booker in the All-Star game. Last time we spoke about All-Star picks, we didn't. Now I think we have. We have to.
And we appropriately hedged while we had that conversation last time, noting the picture would change. You know, I had Christian Wood in my picks, knowing that he was going to be bumped out because of his ankle injury, and he has yet to play since we recorded that episode. So yeah, I think Devin Booker will be taking Christian Wood's spot in my updated picks when we do those.
Yes.
We do have to talk about one other Suns-related story, Mort. They assigned rookie Jalen Smith, who they took number 10 overall. They put him in the G League bubble, which I don't want to frame this as like that means the kid's a bust, because the G League is competitive, first of all, and they don't really have a need for him. Like, I think they're doing it more as our rotation is really full and we just want you to get more minutes and we think you'll play more in the G League and get more experience, and that'll be a good teaching opportunity for you. That said, Mort, it seemed like a reach at the time, and you know, we said the same thing about Cameron Johnson and that worked out well. So I don't want to frame this as this is a mistake or a bust, but knowing that Devin Vassell went 11th and Tyrese Haliburton went 12th, Kyra Lewis went 13th, Cole Anthony went 15th, do you think the Suns are having a little bit of buyer's remorse with Jalen Smith?
Maybe a little bit in terms of the names you brought up. I like Jalen Smith. I think there is some Serge Ibaka potential there as a big. He can stretch the floor, and he's also very capable as someone who can attack the rim. Like, he's really big. Like, he's physically, he's mature and big. And when you look at Basketball References, they list him as at 215 pounds. I would like to see the weight on that. I would like to see him step up on the scale of that, because I don't think that's true. There is some muscle to that kid. And I think you just hit it spot on. This is about him getting some opportunity. He's played, I hit it up earlier, there we go, 50 minutes. Yeah, 50 total minutes. He should basically outplay that over two games in the G League bubble. So this is just a matter of him making the court and getting some chances. I do think that if you compare him to Tyrese Haliburton and Devin Vassell, I would take those guys over him. That said, you could make that case with so many people in the draft, right? I mean, you can always go back to previous drafts. We've done that several times with the redrafts. You know, you can still end up having a very good player on your hands, even though there are one or two guys you could have picked at that spot who would be better. That doesn't mean that he's going to be a bust. It doesn't mean that they will necessarily have a great deal of buyer's remorse. It's just one of those situations where he needs to develop, and right now playing in the NBA is just not a viable option because there's just so many guys up front. You just brought up Saric, who came back as well. Mm-hmm. It's Aiden, it's Saric, it's Cameron Johnson, Jay Crowder, Mikhail Bridges.
Kaminsky, too.
Kaminsky. Yeah, well, you could argue whether or not he should play over Kaminsky because, yeah. But no, I mean, they just have so many pieces, right? So I'm not worried. Talk to me about in 2 years. Yeah. If it's the same thing that where he needs consistent development minutes and he's still not ready, then yeah, then we can talk about it. But right now, that's so down on my list of concerns.
Yeah, I totally agree. I wanted to address it because it happened Monday. But again, given where the Suns are right now, I don't think anyone should really be piling on. You know, and if they took Smith knowing he was more of a forward-looking guy and they felt comfortable about where the rotation was coming into the season, then that's okay. You know, you're balancing the short and the long term here, which I think is
right.
How good teams operate. But yeah, I can't help but wonder seeing Halliburton hit the ground running and thinking, like, you know, could you imagine a lineup with Paul, Booker, Halliburton, Bridges?
Oh boy.
Yeah. It's just
flame. No, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be good. Because he would get minutes. He would be that third guard, I could imagine. He would just get all Cameron Payne's minutes. You could maybe even scale back Chris Paul's minutes load a little bit. That would have been great, right?
Yeah.
No, I think, of course, if they could go back in time, yes, I think they would choose differently. I just don't want to pile on Jalen, because when you played 50 NBA minutes, you haven't had your shot yet.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's fair. I honestly, even the guy with the most minutes this year, who I think is Isaac Okoro.
Yes.
Like, I'm not out on him either. I don't care. These are rookies. These are all, you know, 19, 20, 21. Give him a couple of years.
Yeah.
I'm not concerned.
Yeah. Totally agree there. So let's wrap up with the only team in the league hotter than the Phoenix Suns, the Utah Jazz, who are also, not only are they 9-1 in their past 10 games, the only thing separating them from a 20-game win streak is a loss to the Denver Nuggets on January 31st. They have,
yeah.
They started the year 4-4, and they have won 19 of their last 20 games to get to 23-5. You know, they played the Sixers last night without Embiid, but the Jazz were without Conley. I don't want to say it's a fair one-for-one swap, but they were without a notable member of their rotation. And this storyline has been playing out both for the Jazz and the Sixers recently, where it's just a math problem. For the Sixers, they've been getting outshot from deep pretty consistently over the past dozen or so games. I wrote about that at Forbes Sports recently. The Jazz, on the other hand, they are just bombing from deep. They lead the league in both three-pointers made and attempted. They are fourth in three-point shooting percentage. You know, last night, it was Jordan Clarkson going off. I believe it was for a career-high 40 points. He shot 13.
He gave you guys a 40-piece off the bench with 8 triples.
Yeah.
Yes.
He just couldn't miss. That's what makes Utah so scary, is that they have Jordan Clarkson, Donovan Mitchell, Bojan Bogdanovic, Joe Ingles, Mike Conley. Like, they have 5 guys who can legit go off any single night. So, you know, a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago at this point, we had an episode where we were trying to, you know, sort out. It was the two LA teams were at the top, and then there was like this next class of, these are solid playoff teams, but we aren't sure who's best. Is it Denver? Is it Utah? Is it Portland? Is it the Warriors? Is it the Mavericks? Utah right now has the best record in the league, but I've still seen some skepticism about them and their playoff chances. How would you evaluate them given what you've seen so far this year?
Well, I'm not really that skeptic, but I do see the Milwaukee Bucks concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing to dominate in the regular season, and the playoffs is another beast. I think that's fair. I think it's fair to basically say, until you've proven something in the playoffs, I am not there yet. That's reasonable. But I also think there are certain degrees of which you have to gauge this team, because they are at another level than what they have been before. So I don't think you can lump the 2021 Jazz in with last year's team or the year before that and go, well, I mean, I really doubt them because they didn't deliver last year. No, this is a different team in the sense that they've been together a year longer. The cohesiveness is better. Mike Conley has you know, grown accustomed to the system. Mm-hmm. Donovan Mitchell is a year older. There's just, and also, by the way, even though he had a great season last year, Bojan Bogdanovic was also a new acquisition. This is his second year with Utah. That matters, too.
Yeah.
Just getting familiar with his new surroundings. So, you know, this is a team that does run more smoothly than last year and is objectively better than last year.
Mm-hmm.
So, you have to look at it and go, I can doubt them from a playoff perspective, but I'm not going to doubt them in terms of just how good they are during the course of a full season, because obviously they're one of the best teams in the damn league. Also, I think we are actually personally responsible for them losing that game to the Nuggets, because we're recording.
Oh, yeah.
And we're talking about them, and we're going, this is a huge test for the Utah Jazz. And as we were babbling on, Nikola Jokic dropped 33 points in the first half.
Yep. Yep. That's right.
So I think that's on us. That's on us.
Right after you picked Gobert is your defensive player of the year front runner.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, and then Jokic, that was the game where he went for like a career high 47, right?
Something along those lines, yeah. Yes. Good. Didn't he go for then and then a 50 afterwards? Didn't he go for something? I don't even remember. Jokic just had just insane games. He's always had Gobert's number, though.
Yeah.
Like, that's the one matchup that you just, you probably can't. I wouldn't be shocked if that is the one team Utah just fears the ever-living poop out of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, I think that is part of the skepticism with Utah. I think you're right about the, you know, the Bucks phenomenon of we've seen these really great regular season teams just crumble when they get to the playoffs. Because, you know, in the regular season, you run your system and teams just don't have as much time to prepare for specific counters. Like, they're running their right system, and it's just a matter of whose system, if there's a systemic clash, which one wins out. You know, coaches aren't going to make widespread adjustments unless, of course, with injuries or whatever.
Right.
And we've seen, you know, the Houston against Utah in the playoffs over the past couple of years. I think that's a big fear, where it's like, okay, there are ways to neutralize Rudy Gobert defensively in the playoffs by having a five-out lineup. How many teams have that capability? That's a fair question. You know, right now the Jazz are currently fourth in the league in offensive rating, second in defensive rating. They're the only team to rank among the top five in both categories. So I think it's fair to call them one of the best teams in the league. Like, I think you and I, when they got Conley and Bogdanovic last year, were like, this could be a finals dark horse. We know the LA yep teams are getting all the hype, but this is just, this team makes sense. And then the addition of Clarkson last year early on just gave them that extra firepower they needed off the bench. And, you know, Conley never quite hit his stride last year, but Bogdanovic got hurt with the wrist injury, so they were missing him in the playoffs. So we never really saw the, like, fully actualized version of the Jazz until this year.
Right.
But now, I mean, this is it. And, you know, you're looking at with when the benches shrink in the playoffs, and you're looking at a top eight of Mitchell, Bogdanovic, Gobert, Conley, Royce O'Neal, who is not a high-volume offensive threat by any means, but really good, versatile defender. And it, you know, can knock down, he's hitting 43% of his threes, 4.1 attempts per game. So you can't leave him alone. And then you have Clarkson as the sixth man. There's like the microwave scorer off the bench. You have Joe Ingles as the do-everything guy. You have Derek Favors as a backup center. And you have George Niang as well. Like, that's a really strong 8 or 9 man rotation for the playoffs. I don't think this is a fluke.
No. I don't think. I think a fluke is something else. I mean, this is definitely not that. If people are arguing that this is a fluke, no. This is a sustainable system. And I would also argue, it's for certain matchups, I could see this becoming a final star core still. I mean, you look at the Lakers, for example. I think that's the one team that could fear Utah, right? When you look, because they have the size to make the matchups work.
Yeah.
And as you alluded to, playing five out, the Lakers can't really do that. Not with overwhelming success, at least. They just aren't good enough shooters.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Gobert, you can put on Davis. You know, who do you really put on Donovan Mitchell? Who is quick enough to guard him and like make an impact? Dennis Schroeder, as quick as he is not a strong defender. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is a good defender, but isn't small enough or quick enough to guard Mitchell either. Who's taking care of Bojan Bogdanovic? Like, if LeBron is on Bojan, that doesn't really cancel him out, because then you just take him away from the rim and make him a non-factor.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just so many fun components in that type of series. So, yeah, this isn't a fluke. This isn't a team that you should take lightly. But again, this is one of those major concerns. What if a team just balls out in the regular season that they get bounced in the first round and everyone ends up looking stupid? I think there's that fear.
Yeah.
I think that's what's driving the fear towards Utah. Instead of everyone just jumping on the bandwagon, people are like, but what if they get bounced? What if they get bounced? Then I'd look like an idiot. No. All you can work with is the data you get in the regular season, and then
right. After
that it's a crapshoot. It's matchup dependent.
Yeah, and I think for Utah in particular, you know, especially with this Anthony Davis injury, I think the one seed holds a lot more value to them than it does to the Lakers. Like, the Lakers, I don't think care all that much, but for Utah, I think, you know, getting the one seed, being able to avoid, you know, most likely the Lakers and Clippers are going to be the 2 and the 3 in some order if Utah is the 1. So making them play each other in the second round and not having to go through both to get through the finals, that's huge. So I think, you know, Utah, I don't think they're going to, like, if Donovan Mitchell gets hurt, they're not going to, like, rush him back and try to, you know, put everything on the line in the regular season just to get that one seed. But they might be one of the rare teams where I actually think, you know, it's worth it to go a little harder in the regular season to make sure you have the one seed locked up and you can hopefully dodge at least one of the Lakers and Clippers in the playoffs.
Agreed.
But yeah, I don't know. I buy this team. I think
Because
it's not like I don't have the concern, well, okay, they're a jump shooting team. What if they go cold? I think they have enough individual shot creators in Conley, Mitchell, and Clarkson. Like, Clarkson's really important to this team. I know you're going to crap on the Sixth Man of the Year award, but Clarkson should be running away with it. And it's not just because he's a high volume scorer. He's just really important to what they do.
So if he didn't score the ball for a full game, he'd still be super important.
I mean, he's still able to create off the dribble, and he can create for other players. I mean, there are a lot of teams right now.
Yeah, you're right. His 2.1 assist average is just fantastic. You're right.
I'll tell you this. He'd be immediately the best. Like, what team would he not be the best sixth man on?
Well, just in terms of, are we talking championship contenders here or just overall?
Anywhere. Like, what team has a better guy coming off the bench than Jordan Clarkson?
I mean, Brandon Clarke, guys who play defense. I'm not even sure how many games Brandon Clarke has come off the bench this year, so that might be unfair. But guys who come in and are two-way players are, in my opinion, just far more important. I'm not downplaying the contribution of Jordan Clarkson. Again, I'm downplaying the angle of you have to be a scorer to be a six man. Yeah. It's the award. I just want to make sure the people understand that I don't have a problem with Jordan Clarkson. I freaking love what Jordan Clarkson is doing. He is fulfilling his role to the absolute max. But in terms of the award itself, and I can't even use Brandon Clark because he started 13 games because Jaren Jackson has been out, so that's not even fair.
There you go.
No, but yeah, see, but let me put it this way. Brandon Clark, if he had come off the bench and had been the sixth man that we talked about him as last year, I would have brought him up. I could even make a case for Thaddeus Young this year in Chicago, who's been a two-way player and who's been piling up bunch of assists and like not putting up necessarily a lot of scoring numbers. He gives you rebounding, he gives you playmaking, gives you versatile defense. I don't think you can put him in a vacuum like that and go, oh, is he more important? It's like how a team is designed, though.
Yeah,
like the Utah is designed to have a guy like Jordan Clarkson because he's on the roster. Then Quinn Snyder has made the adjustments like, okay, from our perspective, what we need coming off the bench is a guy who comes in and just kicks ass offensively.
Yeah. Just,
okay, great.
Just totally cooks.
Yeah. I mean, so it. I get what you're saying, and I'm not saying he's not up there in the six-man rankings, if that's what we're going by. It's you can't measure necessarily everything just off of scoring is my point. You know, we all know it's so difficult for NBA teams, even teams that go all in on data. It is so difficult to statistically gauge defense. You agree with me on this, correct?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So we just lean back to what we can quantify, scoring, and what we can track and count every single time. And that's why the sixth man of the year has mostly gone to scores, because it's something we can comprehend. We understand, oh, this guy is scoring X amount of points. That is objectively good, or that is objectively bad, you know, when you look at scoring.
Yeah. I mean,
and that's what so it's a Lacy Award, is kind of my point.
Clarkson is definitely, like, that is his role for sure. But I think it's worth noting that only 18.6% of his two pointers are assisted, only 64.4% of his three pointers are assisted this year. So it's,
oh yeah, he can create.
Yeah,
he can absolutely create.
I think makes him, you know, yes, he's putting up big scoring numbers, but the self creation, I think we should not downplay that aspect of it, because having a guy in that role coming off the bench is what, like, he is the only reason the Jazz weren't down 15 at the end of the first quarter last night. Like, the Sixers were getting anything they wanted offensively in the first quarter, and then Jordan Clarkson came in. I think he hit four threes in the first quarter. It's just like every time the Sixers were threatening to stretch the lead, Jordan Clarkson just came in and just drilled a three right in their faces.
Yeah. I don't disagree. When I made the two assist joke, it was because you said he would set others up.
Yeah.
I agree. That's not his job. I'm kidding. He used to be a point guard. Right. I think he's demonstrated previously that he can do that. I was just cracking a joke on you.
Yeah.
But so let me go to Indiana for a second.
Okay.
TJ McConnell plays roughly a half per game.
Mm-hmm.
Is efficient but doesn't take a whole lot of shots. He's basically the polar opposite.
Yep.
He's a pass-first, defensive-oriented point guard. 6.6 assists per game, 1.8 steals. Those are just the raw stats. Also, by the way, for a guy who's like 6'1 or 6'2, half a block per game, which, but how the hell does that happen? He's averaging more blocks per game than Blake Griffin. That's ridiculous. But let's take a guy like him, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's a reluctant scorer, but he gives you rebounding, 3.5 per game from the point guard position, the backup point guard position. He's giving you playmaking. He's giving you tough note defense. Like last night, he gave Kobe White the business in the first half.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the earliest possessions, he forced Kobe White into a backcourt violation. I mean, this is the type of guy he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's scrappy. He picks you up 94 feet. So, like, how can you gauge that is kind of my point.
Yeah.
If you take Jeremy Clarkson, that's someone else entirely, Jordan Clarkson, and TJ McConnell, and you bring those two up against each other, you go offense, you go defense, okay, but Like, how do you gauge those two components? If you were to merge them, you'd get a freaking all-star.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say if you swap them, which team gets better, which team gets worse. And I was going to
vary. Well, again, scheme, right? Yeah. Scheme. I actually think both teams would get a little bit worse. So you want Jordan Clarkson to have the freedom of scoring. But look, Jeremy Lamb right now is coming back from injury, and he's getting a lot of shots up. So Doug McDermott was recently injured, but he's getting a lot of shots up. Justin Holliday is coming off the bench. He's getting a lot of shots up. Would Jordan Clarkson even find his offensive stride in Indiana? I don't think so. C.J. McConnell, the Jazz would need scoring, because if they swap those two, they would be asking C.J., hey, C.J., we need scoring because we traded Jordan Clarkson for your ass. And C.J. would be like, nope. Because he's a very reluctant shooter.
Yeah.
So again, it's roster design, roster construction, just how players are fit. This is a puzzle. And this is why I'm just bothered by the whole six-man argument that whoever scores the most points will win the award. It's lazy. It's super lazy.
Well, on the puzzle note, I think it's a good way to wrap up Utah, because I think they've really found a roster construction where all of the puzzle pieces just fit very well together. And I'm super excited to see how this team fares over the second half of the regular season, whether they can keep up. I'm not going to say they're going to keep winning 19 or 20 games, but whether they can keep that first seed in the West and, duck one of the Lakers or the Clippers, hopefully, and, see if they can carry this over to the playoffs, because I really do think this team's legit. I do not think this is a mirage that is going to fade away as long as they all stay healthy.
Well, you do realize, because we brought them up again, they're going to lose their next game.
Yeah, who do they play? They play the Clippers for the next two games. But Paul George and Kawhi are hurt. So, yeah, if they lose to the very shorthanded Clippers, which I guess the Heat did last night. So, certainly possible. But, otherwise... So,
mea culpa to Utah fans if that happens.
Well, otherwise, you got two against the Clippers, then Charlotte, Lakers without AD, Miami, Orlando, New Orleans, and at Philly as their last game. There's a non-zero chance they sweep the rest of this. Yeah, or at least 7-1, 8-0 over these next eight games, as long as Kawhi and Paul George are still out.
Can I just ask you a question, by the way?
Yeah.
How bitter are you that the Sixers finally got a very impressive offensive performance from Ben Simmons, where he shot 92% from the free throw line, and you lost?
Not at all.
All right.
Honestly, not at all. When Embiid misses a game, I just immediately chalk it up as a loss, and it's more just a time to figure out what else they can get working. I really liked seeing, they brought Mike Scott in as the starting center, which I've been clamoring for, not because Mike Scott stands any chance as a center, but it forced some interesting cross matches where Ben was guarding Donovan Mitchell, but Gobert was guarding him, and Ben had 19 first quarter points. They just had no answer for him. I think there have been a couple themes. We don't need to go into it today, but a couple themes have become very obvious for the Sixers heading into the trade deadline. These past few games have really emphasized them. So I think there are a lot of silver linings to their three games losing streak, because it's informative. It's giving Daryl Morey a very clear picture of what he needs to do heading into the trade deadline.
I mean, I can't help but ask this question then, because you just said if Joel Embiid is not playing, you basically automatically chalk that up to a loss.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Simmons is supposed to be that secondary superstar, right?
Well,
where you actually rely on him to be able to win you games when Joel Embiid is out.
And if
you automatically go in to a game expecting the team to lose, despite the presence of Ben Simmons,
What
does that say about Ben?
If he puts up 42, 12, and 9, and they still lose by 11, what does that say about the rest of his team? And Tobias Harris has 36 and 10.
That's 36. No. That I agree with, but I'm just basically saying sometimes if you are the secondary guy, you just need to get that W. And if you come in, like, I'm not a Sixers guy.
Yeah.
I don't watch as much Sixers as you do. So I'm actually surprised at your statement. I've never heard you say this before. That's why I picked up on it. For you to basically say I'm just counting them out for when Embiid isn't playing, that to me just... That the reason that jumped to mind was because it feels as though you're basically saying the drop down from Embiid to Ben Simmons as the number one guy on that on any particular night is so big that you can't rely on Ben enough to take you to bring you home a win.
I mean, they're 1-5 without Embiid this year. Their one win was against Indiana, where they were down a million in the fourth quarter and started zoning up and came back. Like, junked up the game and came back. So I think it's more just... I mean, it's similar to Utah, where if everyone is healthy, the team makes sense. But as soon as... I mean, we're seeing it even... Embiid played the last couple games before last night, but Shake Milton was out. And the bench just cannot do a goddamn thing right now because they don't have a shot creator in Shake Milton. Like, Tyrese Maxey is not it. I love the kid, but he's... He is not a primary playmaker at this point in his career. So the bench is just a godless abomination without Shake Milton. And then in the starting lineup, so much of what they do runs through Embiid on both ends of the court. I wrote about this before the Indiana game. I said every time he misses a game, his MVP case only becomes stronger. It's like what we were talking about with Jokic earlier. Pull Embiid out of the Sixers, and they get obliterated. Because offensively, you know, he leads the team in usage rate. He's also drawing a league-high number of free throws. So a lot of what they do depends on feed the ball to Embiid, have him kick it out. If he gets double-teamed, you can create open shots from there. Or draw fouls, get the opposing bigs in foul trouble, and then you get to have easier matchups for the rest of your teammates because you're going against backup bigs. Defensively, he's obviously the fulcrum of the team as well. Ben's really good on the perimeter, but having, you know, if Ben gets blown by or someone else gets blown by, Danny Green in particular, who just on-ball defense is not his forte anymore, you still have Joel Embiid waiting for there in the paint, ready to deter easy layups or block shots or whatever. So, yeah, I don't think this is a Ben thing. I think it's just they... correctly built their team around Joel Embiid, and on games he misses, Dwight Howard ain't it. Or Mike Scott ain't it. I mean, like, going into the trade deadline, they need a more reliable stretch big, because I don't think you can count on Mike Scott in that role, as much as I love him. And they need another ball handler, because they are completely inept whenever Ben or Shake is not on the floor.
Fair enough. To me, it just sounded a little bit like if we can't rely on Ben Simmons, that's a problem. But if you take it into the full context of, you know, the whole roster and not just Ben being that guy, fair enough. I would personally find it problematic if my secondary superstar could not on occasion bring it home for me, but fair.
Yeah, I don't think it's a Ben thing. I think it's just like... this roster is a series of dominoes, and if you remove one, the rest of them fall down pretty quickly. Like, they've covered up a lot of weaknesses because Ben and Tobias and Joe have played so well this year. But this team has no business being at the top of the East. No one had them at the top of the East coming into the year.
Right.
It was like, oh, okay, Daryl Morey, like, sort of fixed the roster. That's cool. Like, they, you know, they've effed up a lot over the last few seasons. They're still very much in undo the damage mode. And they did that to some extent, but, you know, you can only patch holes for so long here. Like, you're still...
And let's just clarify, when you say mess up, because some people are going to read that as, you know, cleaning up from the process period, but that's not what you're referring to. You're referring to No, I know what you're referring to, but I'm just saying, there are still people out there who will contact me, for example, and go, yeah, they really messed up back with the process. And I'm just like, well, that's not really accurate.
The Colangelo and post eras.
Right. Yes, exactly. And Brand is still there, but he just has less control.
Right.
Yes.
He's the quote-unquote general manager, but Daryl is the team president and actually does everything, I think. But
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. Like, it's fair to question That I saw it was. I think Tim Bontemps of ESPN wrote an article calling Ben Simmons an enigma, because it's like when he has performances like this, it is frustrating. Where you're like, where the hell has this been your entire career? Like, you've been going downhill. You're aggressive. Why aren't you like this all the time? I mean, that is the right. ultimate question with Ben Simmons. But I think for him, it's always just been like, you know, he's balancing being a point guard versus being a scorer. And he knows, like, this team runs through Joel Embiid. So when Joel Embiid's healthy, I'm going to give it to him more often than I'm going to, you know, in transition, I'm going to push the tempo. And it's encouraging that he's looking to attack the basket more in recent weeks. And as you said, the free throws last night were fantastic. That's a great sign for a guy, you know, who's been around 60% for his career. But
right.
no, I can't. I cannot pin last night's loss on Simmons or Tobias. It's really the rest of the roster just kind of falling apart in the wake of Embiid and Shake Milton, who I think right. I cannot emphasize enough how much they have missed Shake Milton in recent games.
Fair enough. The shot thing is definitely legit. I mean, he on a per 36 minute over the course of his career, he's only trended downwards. So by this point in about 7 years, he's going to be taking like 5 shots a game.
Ben?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he did say last night, the post game presser, he said it's been a focus of him to be in this mindset more often. So maybe we will see the more aggressive version of Ben Simmons moving forward. I hope so. I think that would
be nice.
It would ease a lot of concerns about who creates offense even in the half court, because they've been, I'll say this, Ben's really gotten more comfortable using these, really, I think he's been using it on both hands, but these little hook shots, like he posts up and he does either a hook shot or like a little bank shot, and it's right. it's been pretty effective. I'm not saying he's hitting it every time, but no. I mean, it's a good way for him to manufacture offense in the half court, not in transition, which has been the concern about him throughout his career, because he's famously right. averse to taking jump shots.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in about 4 years, maybe he'll start launching more threes.
I mean,
I'm completely out on him as a shooter at this point.
Oh, yeah.
I just have no optimism about him turning into a 3-point shooter.
He's like, he practices them. His shot form
I
looks
know.
Good,
I'm seeing that in pregames. Yeah. Like, when I watch them play, he's out there, he's taking threes, and some of them look clean too. And then the game starts, he has like a wide open corner three, and he's just like, nope. infuriating.
Well, I mean, he's just really not in those spots very often. Like, the ball's in his hand so much that it's rare for him to be just posted, you know, like in the corner off ball. Like, that's just not what they do offensively very often. They're going to have Danny and Tobias and Seth out on the corners, and they're going to run snug pick and rolls or post ups with him more often than not.
Look, if he's hitting 56% of his shots and he gets getting to the line more, and apparently, like last night, he's converting at a higher rate, I'm good with that. That's fine.
Yeah, and Doc has just, I cannot tell you how many times of these pressers he's been like, I don't care about Ben scoring. The only thing we care about is him getting downhill and being aggressive. And you guys don't notice everything else he's doing. Like, stop asking about his scoring is basically the subtext to that, which I wrote about recently at Forbes as well.
Yeah. No, I mean, his defense is that is game changing.
Yeah,
I totally agree with you on that. It's like, I think we really should split up the Defensive Player of the Year award to being both interior and perimeter. Mm-hmm. Honestly,
yeah,
I think that would be so much fair. And then Ben would have that perimeter Defensive Player of the Year on lock the next 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, he is. I think the frustration with him is, you know, you haven't seen a ton of strides offensively, especially when you compare him to a guy like Jaylen Brown. But defensively, there is zero question that he is
right.
significantly better from where he was as a rookie to where he is now. He is in full control of that aspect of his game. And he's, I mean, that's, you know, going back to like the James Harden trade talks, like everyone was so ready to, you know, trade him plus a million picks plus Thibault or Maxey or whatever. And it's like, I get it offensively, but he's a huge part of what they do defensively. That you cannot downplay how much they would be losing if they trade Ben Simmons. Like, I'm not saying he and Joel Embiid are going to play the rest of their careers together. It would not surprise me if they ultimately trade one. But I think the more that both Doc and Morey have seen, the more they have grown fond of all of the little things Ben Simmons does, especially yeah. Doc. Doc just absolutely loves the guy.
Yeah. No, and it makes sense because Doug also loves defense. He loves playmaking. He loves unselfishness. And, you know, Lord knows Ben has oodles of both those things. And yeah, 6'11 point guard as well. I mean, who wouldn't love that? Especially when he can actually guard players who are 5, 6, 7 inches shorter than him.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that's a good place now that we've gone on a 15-minute Ben Simmons tangent. That is a good place for us to wrap up. So thank you all, as always, for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. And we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, man. Don't die.